guess we knew the cards were stacked. Started out the best of friends, and we beat that highway till it quit beating back. It didn't mean much in the end. Some you win, some you lose, some you throw away. Headed south across those Colorado plains, just as empty as the day. Looked around at all we saw, and all we'd hoped to see. Looking out through the bugs on the windshield, somebody said to me, no more buffalo, blue skies or open road, no more rodeo, no more noise. Take this Cadillac, park it out and back, mama's calling, put away the toys. Till it makes you sick. What you think you're gonna prove? Just let it dangle till it falls off that stick. That's when you make your move. Don't go chasing after shooting stars, trying to make yourself a name. You can joust at windmills with that old Fender guitar, probably do about the same. No more buffalo, blue skies or open road, no more rodeo for these old. They'd ever doubt my words. I guess they were just too tired to care. I'd point to the horizon, to the dust of the herds, still hovering in the air. Somebody said it ain't any such. Man, you wish so hard, you're scaring me. Cause those are combines kicking up that dust. But you can see what you want to see. And go on chasing after what used to be there. Top that rise and face the pain. But man, they were here, I swear. Not just these bleaching bones stretching across the plain. No more buffalo, blue skies are open.
This is the Insurgent Radio Network calling, and I'm a little low on my volume here. Let's get it up there a little bit. How come that's so low? I don't understand that, man. Well, that's pretty good, but not what I'd like to see it. Insurgent Radio calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, here in the bunker. Right here in north central Indiana, Warsaw, Indiana. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the show, your snail mail, any other contributions that you'd like to send. That's right. And today is the May the 26th, 2014, Moon's Day. Stray Dog was supposed to be on here, but something happened. I haven't heard from him, so we'll carry on here. Yeah, this is Memorial Day. These holidays, and especially this one, makes me sad. I just can't even stand to listen to all the fake and phony so-called patriotism and eulogizing and eulogizing and eulogizing. But they just keep on sending them into these meat grinders. They don't care, but they think they care. They like to pretend they care, but they don't. But all the used car, new and used car lots will be full of people. Walmart will be jammed because shopping is the national sport. And the lower your IQ, the more you want to shop. And so you go up there and try to negotiate the aisles with all those overly obese fat women, and in some cases, fat men. But don't worry, the men are catching up. They just keep drinking that soda and eating that crap. That's why I was thinking the other day, walking down the street, I said, war? This country carrying on a war, a defensive war to defend North America? Forget it. It's not possible. There's not enough people that are physically fit in this country to fight any organized military encroachment. I mean, I look around every day and I say, if anybody wants to invade us, they could take us. Maybe 25% of the country is physically capable of carrying on any prolonged struggle. No, they just want to be like Rome, I guess, a little bit. And depend on their big airplanes and their big rockets and their drones and all that stuff. That'll defend them against any serious encroachment, but I'm going to tell you, it won't. The Maginot Line didn't protect the French. And what was the one that didn't protect the Germans? The Siegfried Line? That didn't stop their getting their ass whipped. But on days like this, I sit back and think, this country's been an aggressive, warmongering country since it turned on itself in the Civil War and beat the drums and blew the horns and marched off into that mess. One thing you got to know about young guys when they go into the service, well, the key word is service. You're a servant. When you go in there, you're thinking all these noble stories that have been planted in all the magazines and books and movies. But once you get in there, then you get into the hardcore training and you say, well, I need this because when it's going to build my character. And everybody tells me, it's going to build your character, son. But when you get up front, if you're in combat, forget all the support stuff, but if you're in combat, you're just out to save your own fucking life. And maybe a couple of guys that you like that are around you. Other than that, it's all total, completely bullshit. They talk about who I hate. Well, let's put the blacks on the shelf for a while, and even the Jews, even though their percentage of them up to their ears in this war profits. I guess I have to admit I hate the so many people around me, the collective white race, not only here but in Europe. I hate them for what they're doing and how they're surrendering and how they think that they're winning and they're losing every time. And Obama goes over to Afghanistan yesterday and says, you did a great job and you did your job and now we'll leave. Wait a minute. What are you leaving? Are you a bombed out country? Hundreds of thousands killed. The poppy fields are bigger than ever. Nation building. No war that the United States has been involved in has had anything to do with nation building. It had to do with destroying nations. I get so sick and tired of hearing the Great War. The Great War. I guess it's got something to do with it that the Jews liked the Second World War. Well, if they didn't like the Second World War, they shouldn't have helped cause it to happen, because the Second World War was directly attributed to the First World War. So there wasn't no Second World War, there was just one war. That war went on and on and on and on. Even the Cold War was part of the First World War. So there was one war, and the United States got into it twice, which it had no business getting into at all. And all those guys that went over there were serving the corporations and the money class and the big banks and ideological nutcases and the Christians and like that. But both those incursions, so-called First World War and Second World War, that the United States got into, would have been over in a lot less time. And millions would have been saved if we'd have stayed out of it, no matter which way the war went. More people were killed because it went on for longer, because the United States got into it. If England couldn't stand its stand and fight, well, he'd be better off under the Germans. Russia had to, they'd already, you know, they lost 20 million people. And prolonging the war, they lost a lot more, but that would have been the end of Stalin and the so-called communist state, which was nothing but a state capitalism, really. Even the Civil War could very well have been avoided. I get so sick and tired of hearing people on both sides eulogizing Lincoln, the war criminal. People love it. Generals and people who are the head of the countries in war, they love it. And generals come home, they elect a president. People say they don't like violence. People lie. They just don't like violence against themselves. They don't care about violence against other people. That's, you know, you see a wreck along the highway. People can't wait. They got to get there, got to slow way down, cause a traffic jam, because I want to see the dead. I want to see the bodies hanging out through the windows. Yeah, that's true. So why don't people admit it? There's a movie that Steve McQueen made years ago called The War Lovers. And it's another one of those anti-war movies that should be shown on television every day. Now, the Republican Party is the funniest. Well, it's obscene, the Republican Party. Now, you expect me to say Democrat. Well, sure, there's more perverts in the Democrat Party, and there's plenty of crooks. But the Republican Party top it all, because when they say they care about the veterans and the ones that died, well, the Republicans are in the forefront all the time, every time. Get into the war, get into the war, get into the Syrian thing, get into this, get into that. Go save the little nigger girls in Africa. You know, meanwhile, you know, there have been a million Rwandans killed. They didn't say anything. You know? They're such hypocrites. They're always out there bombing the shit out of people for human rights. You know, if I was living in those countries, I'd say, please don't be so good to me. Reminds me of a famous line in Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman. When they were kicking in Paul Newman's ass, he was a chain gang prisoner. And he says to his overseer, who'd been beating the shit out of him and torturing, hey, boss, quit being so good to me. And that's the way, you know, now everybody's hating us. Everybody's hating us. And they don't just zero in on the top people that are making all the money out of the wars. They hate all of us. So now you see the way the foreign policy is, that the United States, along with Europe, are playing silly games with Russia. And now you see what happened? Russia just signed the biggest gas deal ever with China, driving Russia into the arms of China. And that is a combination you don't want to see. Now Russia is supplying millions of gallons of water now, diverting water into northern China. China's water table in North China was going down about 10 foot a year. They're running out of water. And that's good in the sense of keeping the birth rate down, keeping the population down. But no, now we've stuck the stick in the beehive, and the beehive bees are coming out. So Russia's making a bad move, but I can understand why they're doing it. In some ways, I admire it. Say, fuck you, Washington. Fuck you, London. Fuck you, Paris. Fuck you, Bonn. You want to play ball? You want to play games? I'll show you how to play games. I'm going to divert all this gas to the Chinese, and you can freeze your ass off next winter. I'll divert all this water to China, which will help the Chinese. Won't help you Europeans at all. But unfortunately, in the end, this is going to be bad. It's going to be bad. It could be really bad because the military-industrial complex are going to start getting ready for a World War III. They'll say, look, Russia's got together with China. They're so big now and so powerful. We better let these missiles go, these bombs go before they get any bigger. That's going to be the next move. Let them fly, man. Let them fly. I always used to wonder about my Uncle Johnny. Came back from World War II with 6 Purple Hearts. But what he had to go through to get them, I'm sure he wouldn't want to do it again. And I often notice he was awfully quiet, really quiet. And he got into drinking too much, like a lot of veterans do. And now that I remember and recall, he had that 1,000-mile stare. You know what they say about guys who've been in the shit? I used to wonder about him. Wonder, why is he so quiet? How come he never talks about it? How come he's got that funny stare? Well, I know now. After studying all this stuff for a long time, you begin to pick up on what's going on. It took me a lot of time. But I know the way the game is played now, and I'm not going to play their game. And I, you know, the right wing are so screwed up. They're going to play the game. They're going to continue to play the game. My country, right or wrong, red, white, and blue, God bless America. But we're racist. We're white racist. We're white nationalist. But we've got to defend the country. What you mean is you got to defend the big banks. You got to defend the top Jews and the top non-Jews that are running the show. They'll throw you into the meat grinder. Defend me. Defend me. All these right-wingers around these militias, I'm listening to them. We're listening to them. Getting all this goddamn military equipment in the local level. You watch out. They're getting ready. You know who they're going to be coming after. Not going to be after their Jew-loving, Christian, patriotic right-wingers. Going to be you and me if you're true to the cause. If you're really into what's going on, you're going to know that we'll be hunted down probably in our own country. But we will fight back with everything we've got. And nobody's going to be innocent. And don't cry when it gets brutal. Because it's going to get brutal. Sooner or later, it's going to get very brutal. Now I'll let you go back to your barbecue and your beer and the ball, nigger ball game, and you're going this afternoon down to see about buying a new car, maybe a new big flat screen, and you're going over to Walmart and into Kmart and into Jew Mart and into Mexi Mart. But for me, this is a shitty day. and I dread it every year. Well, let me put some stuff on here that I think you, I may have played before, but I think you need to hear it again. What happened to the Germans and a lot of other people after World War II? You know, to most Americans, when the war was over, that's it. Everything was fine. Well, let's listen to what was, what really happened.
12 to 14 million German-speaking people, overwhelmingly women and children, were forced from Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and other East European countries, and sent to bombed-out Germany, which had no means to sustain them. Many loaded onto rail cars, just as Germans had done to the Jews. Indeed, Auschwitz was one of the places used as a refugee camp. At least 500,000, and possibly three times that number, died as a result of this ethnic cleansing, done with the support of the United States and Britain. R.M. Douglas writes about this ugly, little-remembered episode of human history in his book, Orderly and Humane, The Expulsion of the Germans After the Second World War. Douglas is a professor of history at Colgate University, and he joins me from public radio station WAER in Syracuse. Thanks for being on our program.
Very good to be with you.
Yours is the first book in any language to tell the story of what happened to these people, at least half a million dead, possibly three times that. Why isn't this more widely known?
A number of reasons. It rubs a lot of people's fur up the wrong way because we are accustomed, of course, to think of the Second World War as a moral crusade, good against evil, which to a very considerable extent it was. And when we start examining some of the sketchier aspects of the Allies' conduct, it complicates that fairly black-and-white narrative. There are legal reasons for not wanting to delve too deeply into this because, as well as being the largest act of what we now call ethnic cleansing in history, it was also very likely, certainly up there, one of the largest transfers of property in human history because the expellees, of course, were expropriated. They lost their land, their houses, their businesses, their personal property. And a lot of those property questions are still very much out there in legal terms. The precise legal ramifications of this transfer still haven't been fully reconciled with international law. So you're pushing a lot of buttons when you start dealing with an episode like this.
What reasons were given for the expulsions?
At the time, it was depicted largely as an act of collective punishment or of re-education of ordinary Germans. The argument was these were all Nazis. If they weren't Nazis, at least they had done too little to oppose Nazism. So they more or less deserved what they were getting. It was also suggested that if you bring home to ordinary Germans that letting a totalitarian dictator take over their country and lead them into aggressive wars will result in unpleasant consequences for ordinary people, then ordinary people will be a bit more careful about letting totalitarian dictators take over. There was a geostrategic argument or political argument. Hitler had started the war in 1939 because there were all these German-speaking colonies or islands of German speakers outside Germany itself, in Czechoslovakia, in Poland, in other countries. He wanted to extend Germany's borders to embrace them, move those people out of where they had been for hundreds, up to 1,000 years, put them into Germany, and the future Hitler won't be able to use that as a pretext for future aggression.
Was this the idea of any one person or organization, or was it just a collective thing among many countries?
The president in exile of Czechoslovakia, Edvard Beneš, who spent the war hanging out in London, was probably the most enthusiastic proponent of these notions. He was the one who really pushed it harder than anybody else. Czechoslovakia was an ethnic mélange. It really should have been called Czecho-Germano-Slovakia because the Germans were actually the second largest ethnicity in the country. behind the Czechs but ahead of the Slovaks. So he wanted, among other things, as well as simply revenge or retribution, to complete his national revolution, have a country that was composed only of Czechs and Slovaks. So he pushed it hard, but he was pushing it an open door. Throughout the world, and especially the Western world in the 1940s, there was a brief vogue for mass expulsions, population transfers, as a way of sorting out the problems of multinational states. The argument was, we tried moving the frontiers of Europe at the end of the First World War to take account of the existing distribution of peoples. That hadn't worked so well. So this time around, we'll keep the frontiers more or less where they are and move the peoples around to suit them.
So Hitler was dead. Who'd we beat up on? This is an act of revenge?
To a degree, but also, as I say, something in which the expelling countries and the great powers each had a stake. Something that solved a lot of problems simultaneously. As I say, for the expelling countries, not just Czechoslovakia, but you look at somewhere like Poland, before the Second World War, less than two-thirds of Poland's population were Gentile Poles. You've got, again, the same kind of problem of too many ethnicities, too many nationalities. Let's thin that out. For the Soviet Union, well, there's an interesting and slightly complicated story. Stalin and Hitler started the Second World War as buddies. They were functionally, I suppose, allies. They carved up Poland between them in 1939, Stalin taking the eastern chunk, Hitler taking the western. At the end of the war, Stalin told the Poles, you know that bit of your country that I've ripped off, the eastern half? Well, you're not getting that back. But don't worry, he said. I'll give you an equivalent piece of Germany, Eastern Germany, in response. So in effect, the entire state of Poland was picked up in 1945 and moved about 150 miles to the west, which meant, of course, that the Polish border was now moving 150 miles inside what had been Germany to that point. There were maybe 8 million Germans living in those lands that are now being turned over to Poland. If they'd stayed there, they would have been about a fourth of the post-war Polish population. Poles didn't want that, obviously, so they all had to go. For the Western Allies, a way of solving the German problem, as I say, a way of re-education, and also a way of currying favor with the post-war governments of these areas, the post-war Czech governments and Polish and Hungarian, so on and so forth. Both the East and the West were bidding for influence and allies in Central Europe, and for the United States and Britain, if you showed yourself to be responsive to these countries' desire to expel their minorities, that is a way of winning friends and influencing people.
And these expulsions were not done secretly, as you put it. They took place without any attempt at concealment, under the eyes of tens of thousands of journalists, diplomats, relief crews, and other observers with access to modern communications in the middle of the world's most crowded continent.
Well, that's true. I mean, when you look at the logistics of this operation, it was absolutely massive. We're not just talking here about, as I say, the largest act of ethnic cleansing in history, although incomparably it was that. Anything that happened in Yugoslavia in the 1990s is put into the shade by what is happening here. It might very well have been the single largest movement of population in all of human history. So we're talking about massive numbers of people that have to be moved, to be resettled, tremendous logistical oomph, so to speak, that has to go into it. Many, many soldiers and officials and other people who have to make it all happen somehow or other. There's absolutely no way you could keep it secret, and there was absolutely no attempt to do so. It was reported at the time, and fairly widely reported.
Explain the source of the title of your book.
Well, immediately after the war, the Allies met, the great powers met for the last of their big three conferences at Potsdam outside Berlin. This was the final get-together before Cold War tensions meant that you couldn't get the three of them in a room anymore. And the three leaders, Stalin for the Soviet Union, Harry Truman for the US and Clement Attlee, Churchill's successor for Great Britain as Prime Minister, said that expulsions would go ahead from three countries, Czechoslovakia, Poland and Hungary, but that they would be conducted in an orderly and humane manner, quote unquote. Now, they already knew, as I said, that this was impossible, that if you're going to carry out something like this rapidly, cheaply, brutally, it's simply impossible for it to be orderly and humane. But at least they were indicating a degree, I suppose, of slight moral queasiness at the job that they were purporting to take on.
How about the traveling conditions? Were they orderly and humane?
Well, in terms of the logistics, as I say, of moving huge numbers of people, civilians, somewhere between 80 and 90% of the expellees, women, children under the age of 16, or the elderly, the mechanics of doing this weren't terribly well understood. So what we're looking at is an enormous exercise in slapdash improvisation. The first thinking was that simply the exercise of terror or sheer force would suffice to stampede all these people out of the communities in which they're living, get them onto the roads and get them across into post-war Germany. And although that was tried in the so-called wild expulsions, basically turning up, surrounding a village, driving the people out at bayonet point in long lines and marching them to the frontier, it didn't work. The numbers were too great. It was all taking too much time. So by 1946, the expelling governments and the big three, between the US and Great Britain, got together for what they called the organized expulsions. And this basically involved herding people together into large camps of various descriptions, as you said, in many cases the same concentration camps that had been used by the Germans during the war, and herding them onto trains. Now, the conditions on the trains were, it has to be said, pretty appalling. The transport system of Europe had been bombed practically to a standstill. For quite short journeys of a couple of hundred miles, it could take 2-3 weeks to get a train across. Very often there was no food or water provided or heating in the wintertime for the expellees. They would be herded into boxcars, 50, 60, 70, 80 or more, into a single boxcar so that they mightn't even be able to sit down for the entirety of this journey. And as you'd expect, especially in the winter, an awful lot of them died and their bodies were simply dumped on the side of the railway line, or on arrival you opened the doors of these cattle cars and you hauled out the corpses.
And the living conditions once they got to Germany?
There again, a huge problem. This is a country that the Allies have been to immense trouble and expense to bomb flat over the previous 5 years, with a great deal of success, it has to be said. So post-war Germany was facing a more serious housing problem than any industrial country in history, basically, to that time. So there was really nowhere for these people to go. The local German authorities had these tidal waves of expellees just dumped in their laps and told, put them where you will. And they put them wherever they possibly could. Schools, churches, barns, caves. And for the overflow, they simply had to fend for themselves. They slept on the platforms of the railway stations where they had arrived. They slept in goods wagons. They slept in graveyards. They slept in public parks. They slept in improvised tents out in the fields. So once again, when the bad weather comes, a lot of them succumb to the effects of malnutrition and hypothermia.
And there was forced labor?
Very much so. Not so much in Germany itself when the expellees arrive, but the expelling countries wanted to get the value, so to speak, out of the expellees before they left. So a lot of them were herded into, as I say, these camps and kept for varying periods, but it could, especially in Poland, be up to 5 years after the war and put out to forced labor under what were in many cases murderous conditions. I've seen some of the contracts that were drawn up between employers of this expellee labor and the Polish and Czech governments that provided them, and they contain things like, you can't make the workers work for more than 98 hours a week without special permission, and things of this nature. But a lot of them were worked to death, especially in Yugoslavia, where conditions for the expellees before their expulsion was probably the worst. About somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 in 3 of the expellees in Yugoslavia who were taken into these camps didn't emerge alive.
And these are mostly women and children, right? The men had been caught up in the war, and many were war casualties.
This is how it is, not just in Europe after the war, but with ethnic cleansing pretty much around the world. One of the tragedies of it is that it affects the static parts of the population, which is the women, the children, the elderly, rather than the mobile, the dynamic ones, the adult males. So yes, incomparably the smallest cohort of the population who is affected by these expulsions were military-age males.
Motivation for Hitler to expand the German Empire was to unify the disparate pockets of Germans living around Europe. After the war, many of these people were loaded onto rail cars and brought back to an impoverished Germany, utterly unprepared for their arrival. R.M. Douglas has written a book on the subject called Orderly and Humane. There's a photograph in your book of a Polish colonist being shown the location of the confiscated German farm he is to receive. Could you put that photograph into context for us and explain how German property was distributed?
Sure. As I say, this was one of the largest forms of or episodes of confiscation and redistribution of property in recent history, quite apart from any other element of the operation. So you had new Soviet-leaning governments being set up in the expelling countries, Poland especially, Czechoslovakia especially, Hungary, of course, and elsewhere. And there was no domestic roots of communism in these areas. Before the wars, these countries pretty much could have held the annual conventions of their communist parties in a commodious telephone kiosk. So one of the ways the new governments got support, or at least acquiescence, from their own populations was by using confiscated German property as a massive slush fund, so that even if you weren't a supporter of the new communist-leaning regimes, your acquiescence or your silence could be bought. In some cases, you got an offer of a confiscated German farm or house or business, and an application to join the party, the Communist Party, in the same mail. It created a kind of Wild West situation. This is, in fact, the metaphor that is constantly used by the Poles and Czechs themselves, because an awful lot of people didn't wait for the government to redistribute German property. They simply went along and helped themselves to it. Either they chased out the German inhabitants and took over the place and said, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law, or they put pressure on the local authorities to give it to them, or in some cases they bribed people to be assigned ex-German properties. So it was a massive scramble. In many cases we have reports of firefights breaking out between rival bands of colonists or Soviet soldiers or militia over this German property.
You write that calculating the scale of the mortality remains a source of great controversy today. Why is that?
Well, part of the difficulty is that we cannot really agree on what constitutes an expulsion-related death. That is to say, where to draw the line. So if somebody dies in one of the camps while awaiting their removal, okay, that certainly qualifies. If somebody dies on the trains, there too. But let's say they arrive in Germany and they have nowhere to live and they're sleeping rough and they don't have food because they've been taken from an agricultural area where there is some food, not a lot but some, and they've been put in an urban area where there's none at all, and they freeze to death in a doorway 6 months or 9 months later. Are they still an expulsion-related death? That's more or less where the controversy comes in. Of course, we also have very poor figures from this period because so many people are moving around. There's so few really reliable records that you can draw upon. So we're throwing darts on a board. But the lowest, the most conservative estimates, as you said in your introduction, come in at about 500,000. The high end, maybe, as you say, 1.5 million. My own suspicion is that the lower estimate rather than the higher would probably be closest to the truth.
Today, 65 years later, are living expellees hard to find?
Not at all. They're getting on in years. I mean, if you were a child expellee in the late 40s, you're probably now in your early mid-70s. But there's still plenty of those around who have first-person testimony to give. And in fact, something in the neighborhood of one in four Germans today is either a surviving expellee or a direct descendant, the child or grandchild of one. So in Germany, at any rate, it's certainly not the case that this was any kind of secret. Over the past 30 or so years, it was considered not a good thing really to talk about. People who did were accused of relativizing the appalling atrocities for which the Nazis were involved, for diverting attention or deflecting attention from the Holocaust and Nazi genocides, even of wanting to reverse the post-war order and go back to the old Hitlerian boundaries of Germany. So a lot of people had their silence very industriously policed in Germany and outside.
You used first-person testimonies from the expellees themselves very little in your book, an intentional choice, you explain. Why?
Yes, pretty much not at all, unless I was able to verify them with quote-unquote impartial or testimony from other sources, especially the records of international humanitarian organizations like the Red Cross. Simply because the whole question of the expulsions is such a hot potato in Europe at the present time, it really is the leading source of tension between the Germans and their immediate neighbors to the east. And because it's so easy to dismiss accounts of dreadful things happening to expellees as a bunch of guilty Germans talking up and exaggerating their experiences so that they can minimize the atrocities for which Germans were responsible during the war. Because that was so easy, I decided, as a kind of command decision when I started my research, that I wasn't going to use this material unless, as I say, I could find it confirmed by an outside source. But the remarkable thing was that the deeper I got into the research, especially in the archives of the expelling countries, the Polish and Czechoslovak state archives, the more I found that the expelling authorities were telling exactly the same stories, almost word for word, as the expellees themselves were. I really didn't need these witness testimonies to be able to say pretty definitively what was going on.
So how's this chapter from history recalled in textbooks in Europe?
By and large, it isn't. It's been too hot a potato to go near. You can wander down to your local lending library, pull out books or histories of modern Germany or of modern Europe, try and find a mention. Go on, I dare you. You may find a sentence or a footnote with some sort of vague reference to the chaos that existed after the war with the movement of populations and displaced people and expellees. That's about as far as it goes. Otherwise, it has been, I won't say airbrushed from history, because that implies some sort of willful or deliberate attempt to write it out of the historical record. The problem is it never got onto the radar screen in the first place.
Same here in the U.S. First time I'm hearing about it. Tell me more about the U.S.'s role in these mass deportations.
The U.S., I suppose, had a fairly inglorious role. The United States government spent most of the war saying, on the one hand, we think that the mass transfer of populations is really a dreadful idea and quite inhumane. On the other hand, we're not really going to consider any of this or discuss it, or certainly not study it or prepare for it, until the war has ended. Well, as soon as the war ended, indeed, before VE Day, these expulsions were already taking place from the areas that the Red Army controlled. And from that point on, the United States simply said, well, it's happening, we're going to have to deal with it. The American ambassadors to the expelling countries were extremely keen that no impediment be put by the United States in the way of these expulsions, because they said Americans are thought of quite highly in these countries, and if we start getting grandmotherly over the Germans and their welfare and weeping tears over them, then we're going to lose all the goodwill that we have built up. So the Americans not just acquiesced in it, but of course they had to collaborate in the movements, because the U.S. was occupying southern Germany, and several millions of expellees were being decanted into American territory. The Americans had to figure out what to do with them. So American liaison officers were appointed to the expelling governments to try and coordinate the movements.
Tell me more about the legacy of this episode in Central Europe today.
It's an extremely controversial question nowadays, and has been ever since, I would say, 2003, when the German expellees organization, their representative body, the Bund der Vertriebenen, started pushing hard for some kind of memorial, or what they called a visible symbol, to be set up, erected to the people who had lost their lives. There was talk of this being a museum, a kind of permanent exhibition, a lot of various ideas canvassed. But of course this caused absolute fury in the neighboring countries, in Poland and the Czech Republic, as now is Slovakia, Hungary. These people pointed out, and they've got a great deal of justification for saying that, what happened after the war was not to be compared with the sufferings of their people under German occupation during the war. And they saw this simply as an attempt to place the sufferings of the perpetrators on a par with the sufferings of the victims. So there was an absolutely massive backlash on the part of the Polish and Czech governments in particular. As I said earlier on, there are also unresolved legal questions. Ethnic cleansing is frowned upon by international law nowadays. There are, in fact, statutes that criminalize it, most obviously the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. And no court has yet determined to what extent it might be legitimate to provide redress to the expellees for what happened to them in the late 40s, being arbitrarily deprived of their nationality, of their property, being exiled from their country. Is there a case, a legal case, for letting them sue, let's say, before the European Court of Human Rights to get their property back? If that were to happen, it would cause just a colossal disruption in the expelling countries, because most of these properties will have gone through a dozen or two dozen sets of hands between then and now. Who is the real owner? Are you going to have a situation in which Poland, a victim of Nazism, just devastated by German occupation, is going to have to pay compensation to expellees? That is absolutely politically unacceptable to the Poles, for obvious reasons. So it became a cause célèbre. It became a hot potato between the German government, which was trying very hard to keep the lid on all of this, and the governments of the neighboring countries.
One imagines a German trying to get reparations for land lost in Poland on orders from the Georgian who was running the Soviet Union from Moscow at the time.
You see the complications. I can even give you an example closer to home. The Secretary of State in the Clinton administration, Mrs. Madeleine Albright, was herself a Czech. She was a little girl called Madeleine Korbel, living in Prague. Her father was a Czech diplomat and ambassador. They had to flee to London during the war because she was Jewish. And when her family went back to Prague after the war, she was, well, her father and her family were assigned a flat that had been owned by a German expellee. They were given it to live in. Now, the family lost the flat. They had to flee after the communist takeover of Czechoslovakia in 1948. But Secretary of State Albright's brother kept some of the artwork that the German family had owned. That family is now suing the brother for the return of that artwork. They haven't got very far because Mrs. Albright's brother says, well, I was assigned it legally under Czech law, and that's the end of it. I'm keeping it.
My guest is R.M. Douglas, professor, historian, and author of the book Orderly and Humane, The Expulsion of the Germans After the Second World War. We'll conclude after a break. His book, Orderly and Humane, details the forced migration of Germans in post-World War II Europe. Is there debate among historians about how this period of history should be written about?
I think it's just starting. One of the reasons that I wrote this book was that certainly in the Western world and the, well, outside Germany anyway, in the English-speaking world, this was an enormous vacuum. I was myself a professor in my liberal arts university in upstate New York. I was trying to teach my students about what happened to Central Europe after the war, how it was that the most heterogeneous, the most mixed part of the continent almost overnight became the most homogeneous. And there was just nothing reliable. Lots of polemical works and bitter, emotion-filled works, but absolutely nothing scholarly that I could assign to them to explain to them what happened. And many of the questions that I had myself, there weren't answers to. Even how many of these camps there were for expellees, this archipelago, as I've described it, of internment camps, detention camps, forced labor camps, even what the expelling countries themselves called concentration camps. So I set out to write this book partly, as I say, to draw attention to what is an immensely important element of explaining the current architecture of Europe, political, economic, social, cultural, but also to answer these very fundamental questions that we should be able to say we know about, but as yet don't.
In October 2009, the president of the Czech Republic refused to sign a European Union treaty until other nations agreed that his country would not be liable if expelled Germans tried to regain their properties lost more than 60 years ago. So did they?
They did not. Well, that is to say, the Czech president got the opt-out that he asked. The other countries of Europe said, okay, we will revise the treaty so that expellees cannot challenge their treatment in the camps or their deprivation of property in the European courts. So to that extent, that did go through. Otherwise, there really hasn't been much change since 2009 legally. Various survivors have tried to bring cases before the European Court of Human Rights or the United Nations Human Rights Council, and nearly always these have been shot down on procedural grounds. In other words, these international tribunals, who don't want to touch these questions with a 40-foot barge pole, have said, you haven't exhausted your domestic remedies. Go and bring your complaint in the Czech courts. Bring it in the Polish courts. When they've finished, if they don't give you satisfaction by the time you finish that process, however long it takes, yeah, then get back to us and maybe we'll consider it.
Good luck.
It's very
that.
Hard. Exactly. The Czech Constitutional Court in particular has proved an absolute master at throwing up ever more arcane procedural obstacles, in some cases dragging these suits out for 20 or more years. And it's very hard to avoid the conclusion that the legal authorities, both domestically and internationally, are trying to spin things out until such time as there won't be any surviving expellees.
What sort of public accounting or reckoning of this would you like to see happen?
Well, it's one of those episodes, as I say, that challenges our knee-jerk response to the Second World War as a good war. It was a good war, emphatically, in the sense that it was absolutely vital that the Axis be defeated, and defeated as comprehensively and quickly as possible. It was a good war in the sense that the Allied cause was, on the whole, just. But that doesn't mean that everything that was done during the war, and certainly not everything that was done after the war, was likewise good and just. So we have to maintain two truths running around our heads at the same time that may seem in contradiction with each other but aren't. Firstly, we must remember that anything that happened after the war, including these expulsions, was put into the shade by the quite indescribable brutalities of the Nazis during the war. We must never forget that or get into some kind of relativizing exercise where we say, this is in some respects just like the Holocaust, or it's, you know, 30% of a Holocaust or anything like this. This kind of comparison absolutely doesn't work. But by the same token, we cannot fall into the opposite error of assuming that unless a mass human rights abuse ascends to the, or descends to the level of what the Nazis have been doing, that we simply aren't going to notice it. It is, from my point of view, a really scary thing that something like this could happen, as I say, in a very closely scrutinized part of the world, in living memory, and we're completely oblivious to it. It makes us wonder what other things, other infamies, we may be capable of forgetting or ignoring simply because they're happening to people that we instinctively dislike.
R.M. Douglas is a professor at Colgate University and the author of Orderly and Humane, The Expulsion of the Germans After the Second World War.
Back in 1927, I had a little farm and I called that heaven. Well, the price is up and the rain come down and I hauled my crops all in the town. I got the money, bought clothes and groceries, fed the kids and raised the family. Rain quit and the wind got high and a black old dust storm filled the sky, and I swapped my farm for a Ford machine and I poured it full of this gas Eileen and I started rocking and rolling over the mountains out towards the old Peach Bowl. Way up yonder on a mountain road, I had a hot motor and a heavy load. I was a-going pretty fast, I wasn't even stopping, a-bouncing up and down like popcorn popping. Had a breakdown. I'm sort of a nervous bust down of some kind. It was a feller there, a mechanic feller, said it was engine trouble. Way up yonder on a mountain curve, it's way up yonder in the piney wood, and I give that rolling Ford a shove, and I was going to coast as fur as I could. Commenced coasting, picking up speed. It was a hairpin turn. I didn't make it. Man alive, I'm telling you, the fiddles and the guitars really flew. That Ford took off like a flying squirrel, and it flew halfway around the world. Scattered wives and children's all over the side of that mountain. We got out to the west coast broke, so that gum hungry I thought it'd croak, and I bummed up a spud or two, and my wife fixed up a tater stew. We afford the kids of it. Mighty thin stew, though, you could read a magazine right through it. Always have figured that if it'd been just a little bit thinner, some of these here politicians could have seen through it.
Well, there's a little something you can... Too much sound there. Well, chew on that for a while. And that's only one of the genocidal things that have killed off millions of white people. But they don't cry at all. They buy new cars, buy big television sets, and go watch Niggerball. The Jews cry all the time. They'll never quit crying. But this is how the ruling class, and I'm putting the corporations, the churches, and everything all in that same pot, always maneuver us into killing ourselves. Got to hand it to them, they're pretty smart. If we're not killing some other people clear halfway around the world for no real reason, except to steal what the hell they've got. If not for that, we're killing each other. The ruling class convinces us to kill each other, like the Civil War was. Anyhow, that's it for today, Moon's Day. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Tears Day. In the meantime, take care of yourself and your family and like that. Forget about the system. The system is your enemy. System always was your enemy. It didn't just start. No matter what they call it, no matter what name they put on it, it's your enemy. Work for your own situation and others that understand the program. As far as the others that don't understand war is a racket and war is a Jew harvest, well, there's nothing you're going to be able to do to them because they're not listening. They're just getting fatter. 14.5 and shut up.